We set ourselves some tasks so we could get familiar with some methodology, so that we could get more familiar with the molecules we've been talking about. In this case, amino acids. And the methodology, that the task we set ourselves was to sequence a protein using admittedly somewhat old-fashioned methods. So we've gotten as far as chewing up this oligopeptide, let's say up to 20, so that amino acids came out one at a time. And now we want to identify what it is in the tube that we collected as falling off of this captured oligopeptide. So we have to take advantage of the characteristics of the amino acids and how one differs from the next. So one very obvious difference is their net charge. So they could be charged, positive and negative, as we saw the Zwitterion of amino acids, and have no net charge. But if they have a net charge, minus or positive, then they will respond to an electric field and migrate if they have the chance to move. We give them the chance to move in a technique called paper electrophoresis, a very old technique, in which we can apply, say, our amino acid to the center here of a wet, this is a side view of a large piece of filter paper, sort of like thin blotting paper, and wet the whole thing with a buffer, let's say at pH 7, but we're in control of it. We could do it at pH 1 or 2, as you'll see in some of the problems. And then we put this wick down at the bottom so everything stays wet and everything is electrically connected through the salt solution that they're in, so a current can run. And we attach it to not a battery, but a source of very high voltage. And then we turn on the electrical potential and voltage, and we see what happens. And what will happen is that those amino acids that are negatively charged, let's use this simple example, alanine. So you may not remember what alanine is, but it might be handy to keep your 20 amino acid sheet in front of you as we talk about amino acids. So alanine has just got a CH3 side group. Glutamic acid has a carboxyl group, so it's acidic. And lysine is that first amino acid we looked at, is an amine. So after a couple of hours of applying this voltage, we take off this filter paper and dry it down and then spray it with a reagent, say, that reacts with all amino groups and gives you a purple color. There is such a thing. We'll see that the alanine has hardly moved. The lysine has moved towards the cathode, which is the negative pole in an electrophoresis setup, opposite of a battery. So the cathode is negative, and an ion which moves towards the cathode is in fact called a cation. Positively charged ions are cations. Lysine would be positively have a net positive charge because it has two amino groups and only one carboxyl group as a free amino acid. And glutamate, or glutamic acid, the opposite, would have a net negative charge, two minuses and one plus. And so it'll move towards the anode, being an anion. So we can separate those pretty easily. Oh, here's the structures to remind you. Forgot I had that. And these electrophoresis apparatuses have to be designed carefully so that, you know, all the current is electricity is shut off as soon as you open it, so you don't get a shock. Because certainly 2,000 or 3,000 volts, which is necessary here to get these amino acids to move in a reasonable amount of time, is lethal. So that's all pretty straightforward. The second method we'll talk about, which is much more powerful, really, takes advantage of another characteristic that we already talked about a little bit, of how one amino acid varies from the next, and that's how hydrophobic it is. So we have some amino acids that have all CH2 and CH3 groups, and some that have that, like lysine, which has this charge, so that's pretty polar, although it has a long stem of CH2s, so it's not so clear. So the thing is with hydrophobicity, it's like a continuous gradient, and it's quite subtle differences can make a difference. So how do we take advantage of the hydrophobicity? So paper chromatography. Now, chromatography is a very general word, and really the chrome just refers to historically separation of plant dyes. And you'll hear about, say, ion exchange chromatography. So that depends on the ionic properties of the molecules you're talking about, much like electrophoresis, alternative. Or affinity chromatography, so some medium in which your small molecule has an affinity for some reason for a particular solid substance, right? Paper chromatography, so paper is, in paper electrophoresis, the paper is sort of incidental. We could have used some plastic membrane or some gel. But in paper chromatography, paper is playing a very active role in the separation. Operationally, what you have is, again, the same kind of paper you would use in paper electrophoresis. It's quite absorbent. And you could spot, say, in this case, different amino acids, just as a trial, polar ones and less polar ones. You could spot them in a line a bit up from the bottom, and then dip the bottom, but don't dip the spots you just spotted and dry down on there into this reservoir. And the reservoir is almost always made up of a mixture of an organic solvent and water, or a buffer. So you can control the pH. So the organic solvent could be, a very popular one is a butanol. So that's got four carbons followed by a hydroxyl. Or isopropanol, which looks like this. So you see it's got a lot of hydrophobic character, but it does have this OH, which makes it, that's enough to make it mixable with water. So as you know, you buy 70% rubbing alcohol is isopropanol. So isopropanol in water, say, down here, let's say it's 50-50. And this liquid then, for this dry paper and the dry down spots of your amino acids, will start to rise up through capillary action, just with the tension between the little fibers of the cellulose. And left alone, it will just keep going up and up and up. Actually, it will start to evaporate as it slows down, as it's trying to go further and further up. But if you put this whole business into a big jar and seal the jar, then you're not going to get any more evaporation. You'll get saturation of the atmosphere inside with water vapor, and the front here of liquid just keep going up and keep going up until it reaches the top. You stop it before it reaches the top. That's of some importance. And that's called the front. Right? So it's the front of the liquid moving up, and the liquid contains water and isopropanol. So what's happening as this liquid gets to the applied amino acid? Let's consider a mixture of a polar molecule, black square, and a nonpolar molecule, red, yellow circle here. As the water goes up, because cellulose is just filled with these hydroxyls all over the place sticking out, the water is going to have great affinity through hydrogen bonding for the cellulose. The isopropanol, much less so. Just got one possible group here that could form a hydrogen bond, and most of it is hydrophobic even. So microscopically, along the surface of this paper, you have two phases. You have the water phase, and you have the isopropanol phase. And the water phase, the water molecules are going to be bound and hung up bonding to this cellulose. This is a little hard to imagine. So it's a little harder than paper electrophoresis. But as a result, everything is still moving, but the water has this layer of molecules that is sort of stationary. It's called the stationary. It's really less mobile compared to this isopropanol, which is running up to the top without much hindrance from the cellulose hydroxyls. Right. Now consider the stuff that's mixed in here that's soluble in these two. They're going to dance around and enter one phase or the other. But the ones that are more polar will spend more of their time in the polar solvent, interacting with water. And as such, they will be, if this is a race to the top, they will be distracted by this bound water layer. You could also do this whole experiment using tubes and shaking up two solvents. And there are actually complex apparatuses for that. But this is a lot simpler. It's almost as if each little piece of the paper was a little test tube in which you're seeing how much of your how much of your solute will go into the isopropanol phase and how much will go into the water phase. So they're being carried up along, and the polar molecules are being slowed down, whereas the less polar or nonpolar molecules will spend more, or even all of their time, in the isopropanol. If they spent all of their time in the isopropanol, then they would be at the front. But they spend some time in water. So even the most polar, least polar, the most hydrophobic one, I might have misspoke a second ago, the least polar one will go the fastest, being in the mobile phase, which is the organic phase, which is in this case isopropanol. Could be even benzene, which makes kind of a partially soluble in water. So when you're done then, you stop the whole reaction before before the front goes past the top of the, goes to the top of the paper, and then you can make a pencil line where the front is. Now you can dry down the paper, and you can stain it again for a stain that just reacts with all amino acids, and you'll see a bunch of purple spots. So if these are the amino acid mixture you put on, you'll see that aspartate, which has a full negative charge on its side group, compared to all these other amino acids, is the most polar, and it has gone the least. And you can measure it. This spot, say, the top of it or the center of it, has only gone about 10% or 11% here with that precision, as high as the front. And so you say this has a value of 0.11 mobility relative to the front, or its RF value is 0.11. Serine is polar but not charged, so it's a little less polar than this charged aspartic acid, and it goes with a value of 0.27, et cetera, et cetera. And isoleucine here wins with an RF of 0.82. You could write those numbers down, possibly publish them in a vanity press book, and you say, well, if you take 50-50 isopropanol in water, and you buffer it at pH 7 with such and such a buffer, and you run it at 22 degrees room temperature, and the time doesn't matter because it's all relative to the front. So you don't have to specify a time. If you had stopped the paper chromatography after half this much time, the front would only be here, and all these values would be the same relative to the front. So if you have now a mixture, if you have an amino acid that came off your carboxypeptidase reaction, and you run it here, and you see it comes out here, you could say, well, that's consistent with it being, according to this book, that has a 0.44, well, that's close enough, within the error of my experiment, that's probably glycine. But to be sure, you would probably buy some glycine from Sigma Chemical Company and run it alongside, repeat the experiment perhaps, or even do the experiment, it's a big piece of paper, you could run all 20 amino acids. If you ran all 20 amino acids, you would see you get lots of different distances, but you don't get 20 distances. You get some distances that are just the same for two amino acids. Right? So maybe glutamine and asparagine, they ran the same. That extra carbon didn't make any difference in this respect. You say, OK, maybe that's the way they behaved in this solvent, but suppose I switch my solvent or change the pH and run it again. And again, maybe you get 15 out of 20 spots, but they're different ones. So between two different solvent systems, you can actually resolve all the amino acids from one another. And if you're content to do two paper chromatography experiments, you can identify whatever of the 20 amino acids you have in your tube. So this is a powerful method. And it's sophisticated in its operation. But the materials you need, on the other hand, are very simple. This is about the simplest paper chromatography apparatus you could have. It's just a beaker. And you've cut down on the evaporation by covering with this aluminum foil. And this is a felt tip, black felt tip pen ink, separating into various colors that are mixed to give you the black. More seriously, you would put it into a bigger or a jar that had, a ground glass top. And you could put a glass plate on the top and put some grease around it, like Vaseline, so that you'd really seal it. So that's paper chromatography. So those are the two methods, and we have some problems on those. And you can do it, you know, at different pHs, and you would have different predictions about how things would work. So now we have the sequence of something that's maybe as 20 long, but our proteins are typically much more than 20. They're 100 or 200 or 500 amino acids long. So how are we going to get the sequence of the whole polypeptide? Well, we'll just cut it up into bite-sized pieces here using a proteolytic enzyme. This is not carboxypeptidase was our sort of sequencing enzyme, and it went in from the outside. It was called an exoprotease. In this case, we'll use an endoprotease. So these are proteolytic enzymes or proteases, that's synonymous, that will cleave, and will cleave, however, with great specificity, just as carboxypeptidase had specificity only for the carboxyl end, so the endopeptidases, most of them, have great specificity. This particular one called trypsin, name tells you nothing. It's made in our pancreas, and it helps us digest our steaks. And it will cleave after lysine or arginine. And if you look at your sheet, you'll see that arginine, lysine you already remember, I just showed it to you. Arginine is also an amino acid that has a positively charged side group, has this guanido group, which is one of your functional groups. So it's looking for positively charged side groups, and it cleaves after it. What does after mean? After refers to the convention that we write our amino acids and our peptides, unless there's some reason not to, we write them from the N-terminal on the left to the C-terminal on the right, and we're talking and writing in English, so that's forward. So after means on the carboxyl side of the residue that is lysine, or the residue, that is what's left of the amino acid, which is most of it, of arginine. And you'll add, this is hydrolysis, but it's catalyzed by, and these hydrolysis have to have a catalyst, and these catalysts are very specific. So this is an enzyme that catalyzes the hydrolysis of polypeptides after lysines or arginines. And so we get, depending on where lysines and arginines are, we get a bunch of these, what I call subpeptides. You won't see this referred to anywhere else. And I think it's clearer to call them subpeptides instead of just peptides in this context. And then we could separate this on the basis of size, which I won't tell you how now, but we'll talk about it probably next time. And then purify each one, and then subject each one of these to carboxypeptidase and paper chromatography, et cetera, and then get the sequence of each one. So then we have the sequence of the entire polypeptide, right? Well, not quite. We have the sequence of all these subpeptides, and we see, you know, where they are. But we see where they are because I drew it for you this way. In reality, you just have this tube with this protein in it, and you have separated these pieces on the basis of size, and you sequence them, but you have no idea how they fit together, what the order of these subpeptides is in the original polypeptide. So there's a nice logical way to get around that, is we repeat the whole experiment. We keep that data, we write in our notebooks, and then we repeat the whole experiment using a different endopeptidase, one that cleaves not after lysine and arginine, but one that cleaves after with some specificity after some other amino acid. So chymotrypsin, another protease in our pancreas, secreted by our pancreas, cleaves after tryptophan, tyrosine, and phenylalanine. And if you look at your structures, you'll notice that they have a commonality too. They all have an aromatic ring that is one of these double bonded ring structures. So that's what this enzyme is looking for before it will cleave, and it will cleave after them, which I've explained. So we're going to get a whole new set of peptides from the same polypeptide, cutting with this red enzyme now. And now we get red subpeptides, which are those produced by chymotrypsin. Now we have, and then we sequence each of those. It's a big deal, sequencing a protein by its amino acid. It's hard. And it's easier nowadays, but I'll show you the old methods because they're more instructive for getting familiar with the amino acids and the peptides. So here we have, let's say, this guy up here. We put him over here, and now they came from the same polypeptide. So they have to have certain things in common, the red ones with the black ones. And so we look for what they have in common. So we see that this big red one, maybe over here, I don't know, I might not have been careful enough to get the sizes right. This big red one has a commonality at one side. There's an overlap. And we can see that we have ala, gly, lu, tire, over here, and then this one starts over here in the lined up allogy, and it came from the same place. So, and we could even see that here you'd expect to see what? A lysine or an arginine right here in this guy that wasn't cut. And over here, where this overlaps, you'd expect to see an aromatic amino acid. So you just keep doing this and looking for the, and lining them up one to the other. You have all the data, and now you sit down with a pencil and paper, and you line them up like this. And there's another one, and we're almost done. Let's get rid of that noise. And there's the last one we have, and sure enough, that fits with the other. So it's like a jigsaw puzzle almost. We're done. Now we do know the sequence of the polypeptide, and we have it in duplicate, really. As one aids the other in how you put these things together. You'll have one little problem on this for a very simple peptide, oligopeptide, not a whole polypeptide. Okay, so we're done sequencing our polypeptide, and we know how to do that. If we look at different proteins, they will have different sequences. Sometimes we want to look for a subtle difference. It's instructive to look at a subtle difference between two very similar proteins. So for instance, if there's a protein that we all have, but that is a cause, but whose activity is necessary for full function, but is maybe affected in some pathological situation, then we'd like to know where the problem is. All right, that's a little coy. Vernon Ingram, in the 60s, when this sequencing business was going on, he was interested in finding out what's wrong with people that have blood diseases, diseases that might affect hemoglobin, he thought, the protein that carries oxygen from the lungs to the tissue in our bodies. So there's people that have blood disease problems. One of them is a sickle cell disease, which is kind of a mechanical kind of problem. There's nothing wrong with the hemoglobin in carrying the oxygen, but if you look at the person's red blood cells, whereas a normal red blood cell would be sort of saucer-shaped like this, these round ones, like a flattened ball, and rather smooth. In this case, we have some misshapen ones that are like a crescent or a sickle, and that's the name of the disease. Now those smooth red blood cells, which are very small, they've lost their nucleus, they're not dividing anymore, they're essentially bags mostly of hemoglobin. About 80% of the protein in red blood cells is hemoglobin, and its job is to, as I said, to carry the oxygen. In the course of that job, you have to go through blood vessels, and arteries, and veins, and you have to go through capillaries. They get smaller and smaller, and sometimes some of our capillaries are so small, so narrow, that they're only big enough for one red blood cell, which itself is about a tenth the size of our skin cell. They're pretty small. So these smooth guys get through okay, but these guys clog it up, these sickle cell red blood cells, and people that have this disease. And their capillaries get clogged up, it's very painful, and it's a very serious disease. Right? And they're usually episodic. They have these bad episodes where they get a clog. So why is it that they're like this? Since 80% of the protein is, you could think maybe something to do with the membrane, that would have been reasonable. Ingram thought, well, maybe it has something to do with their hemoglobin because there's so much hemoglobin in there. I don't know what gave him that insight, actually. So he decided to compare the hemoglobin in people with sickle cell disease compared to normal. But he didn't want to have to go through that whole business. And he was looking ahead to other blood diseases where people can't carry oxygen so well, and that's more likely to be a hemoglobin defect. And he wanted to compare lots of essentially mutant hemoglobins, globins he suspected, because these diseases are inherited, right? So he knew that 60s, you know, they didn't know a lot. So he devised this method called fingerprinting, which enables you to get a quick look at the whole protein sequence, an indication of it, but not the exact sequence. And it works like this. First, you start the same way as we did to get our subpeptides, to cut them down to bite-sized pieces for sequencing. So he has these triptych peptides, they're sometimes called, or peptides, subpeptides. Right? And now he says each of these peptides is going to have some character, much like the amino acids, except they'll be the composite of all the amino acids that's in them. And so that should be able to separate them all and then see if there's any difference between normal hemoglobin from a normal person and hemoglobin for a person that has a blood disease like sickle cell disease. And he devised this very powerful way of separating them. But before we look at that, let's consider what he meant by composite character. So here's a hexapeptide, right? I just made up. And it starts here with alanine and ends with tryptophan. What might you call this? You call this ala-tyre-glu-pro-val-trip. That's the simplest way, like here. But as you do your reading, you might see the single letter abbreviations, which are more cryptic. Right? W for tryptophan. Right? Or you might see something weird like this, sort of lyrical, which in which everything preceding the last one is made into an adjective to be grammatically correct, sort of. All of these are adjectives preceding the noun here. So you see alanyl, tyrosyl is just the adjective for those amino acids. So it's just not important, but in case you see it, you shouldn't get confused. Okay, so we have this alanyl, et cetera guy. And let's see, how about the charge? We talked about charge as the first characteristics. Let's look at the charge. First of all, it's got two ends, so they're going to be charged and they're going to neutralize each other. So we have a positive and negative charge, and we have any side change. There's one, glutamate, it's the only one. Glutamic acid is negative. So you have two negatives and one positive. This peptide has a net charge of minus one, just as glutamic acid, as an amino acid, has a net charge of minus one. So does this peptide. Maybe you would have two lysines in here, it would be a different story, right? Just add them up. So this is going to migrate towards the anode in a paper electrophoresis. And some other peptide would not, or maybe another one would also. But it would start to separate peptides on the basis of the net charge. Now he's going to take that other method that we described, partially so we could use this fingerprinting, paper chromatography. So how hydrophobic is it? Well, it's got this polar groups on the end, but that's the same for all of them. So we have alanine, a little bit hydrophobic. Tyrosine is pretty hydrophobic with this, all these seven CH2s or CHs. Glutamic acid, definitely polar. Right? Proline, hydrophobic. Valine, hydrophobic. Tryptophan, hydrophobic. So it's got 5 out of 6 are hydrophobic, and one spoiling the party. Pulls back from that hydrophobicity a little bit. Still, it's going to migrate then in paper electrophoresis at the composite hydrophobicity of the entire polypeptide, entire peptide. You can't do this with a polypeptide, it turns out. So you get too long, they will actually precipitate in the presence of organic solvents. And maybe we can come back to that question if somebody's interested in why. But up to 20 or 30, they are soluble, and they will move in paper chromatography according to their composite hydrophobicity. The more hydrophobic, the further they will go. Here's the experiment. So you start with a big square of filter paper, and you put your tryptic hydrolysate, you could call it, the result of hydrolysis using trypsin, all those, just the tube with all those imagined subpeptides in it, and we spot it right along one edge, and then we apply the electrophoretic, the voltage with a positive pole here, negative pole here, and let them separate. And so you'll get some separation of the peptides. Now, these aren't amino acids anymore. These are peptides. And the negative ones will go here, and the positively charged ones will go down towards the cathode. When that's done, you stop, and you take out the paper, and you dry it, and you turn it 90 degrees. So now your separation is at the bottom. And now you put it into paper electrophoresis, being careful not to let the liquid go above your spot. We want it to rise through the spot. And now we separate each of these spots that could have several peptides that had the same net charge. Right? And we separate them based on hydrophobicity. So we have these two-dimensional separation. It's called a two-dimensional separation. It's much more powerful than a single separation. And we have this whole pattern of spots. And that pattern of spots depends on where the lysines and arginines are for cutting, and then what's in between them. And what's in between them is dependent on the sequence of the polypeptide. And in general, the proteins are defined as having a particular sequence, has a particular name, does a particular job. Another protein will have another job, another name, and a different sequence. So every protein, by definition, has a different primary sequence, has a different sequence of its amino acids. And therefore, it's likely that all of the subpeptides, among all the subpeptides you get, many of them will have different characteristics because their sequences are different. Now, in this case, he did not a completely different protein, which have a completely different pattern, but the protein from the hemoglobin from a person with the sickle cell disease. So if he is wrong about his hypothesis and had to do with some membrane protein, it would look identical to this. I wouldn't be telling you the story, obviously, if it looked identical. So we see there is a difference. Many of them are the same, but only one spot, one subpeptide is different in this boxed here. So we see over here, it had moved. Remember, keep track. This had moved towards the anode, so it was negatively charged. Whereas this guy is sort of in the middle, looks like it lost its negative charge. From the normal people, it went up a certain amount of hydrophobicity, but compared to that, in the people with sickle disease, it went further, meaning it got more hydrophobic and it got less charged. So finally, he says, OK, I have to know what it is. So he cut out this peptide, and he cut out this peptide, and he subjected it to sequencing. But he didn't have to sequence the whole thing, which is 16,000, about 130 amino acids or so for this protein, a globin in hemoglobin. And sure enough, what he found was that at one position in this peptide, there was a glutamate, and it was changed to a valine in the people with sickle disease. So a single. Then he went on to, you know, to make sure he sequenced the whole thing, and that was the only change. So a single amino acid substitution of valine for glutamate, and the characteristics are consistent with his separation. That the peptide that contained this, these dotted lines are the rest of the peptide, right? And that's apparently the cause of this disease. So it's not obvious why that should be a cause of this disease, but we'll get to that next time. And Ingram went on to look at many other called thalassemias, which are blood diseases of the that are inherited and are due to amino acid substitutions in the hemoglobin proteins. So this is just an example of four different polypeptides and their different fingerprints. So they're called fingerprints because they are characteristic of each protein. Some of you will be confused and will forget or lapse back and think that these are amino acids. Suppose we did a complete hydrolysis instead of this trypsin cutting at specific places. If we did a complete hydrolysis, is there any proteolytic enzyme that will do that? Not that I know of, but it's easy to do chemically if you don't. You don't care about where it's cutting. You can put your polypeptide into 6 normal hydrochloric acid in a sealed tube and raise the temperature to 120 degrees centigrade overnight. And then when you come back in the morning, you have amino acids. They're all completely hydrolyzed chemically and nonspecifically. If you ran this two-dimensional separation, I can't call it a fingerprint because it won't be a fingerprint. But if you run this two-dimensional separation on that mixture of amino acids, virtually every protein will give you the same pattern. And it would just be where the amino acids are, because almost all proteins have all 20 amino acids. All right, granted, the intensity might be a little different. One protein's got a lot of lysine, the other protein's got a lot of alanine. But that's a little hard to quantify and compare two proteins that way. So the composite property of the peptides is at the root of this fingerprinting technique. Okay, now we're back to the straight lecture and not about these methods. And I have some props. Let's now consider the three-dimensional structure of the proteins, just as we did for polysaccharides and for lipids. I think you can see that, not too important. If we take, just so we know where we're starting from, if we take a protein, let's say it's a polypeptide, a single polypeptide chain, it's a protein, has an English name, by definition, every one of those molecules has the same sequence of the amino acids. So it's met, ala, whatever. This is, I think, henalbumin. If we took a second molecule out and we could look at a single molecule, which we can't, but if we could, we had seen the same exact sequence, etc. So we start with that. But now we think about the three-dimensional structure of molecules 1, 2, 3, and 4. So here's a model, it's actually to scale, of a 500 amino acid protein, and just showing the backbone, not showing the side chains. So that's a half inch, and this is 16 feet. So you have this long thing like this, right? And you're going to put it at 37 degrees, which is, let's say, a jacuzzi at 37 degrees. You can imagine this molecule is jumping around like this. And you took a second molecule, it would be jumping around like that. So this is the wrong picture. I often start with the wrong picture. So that would be called like a random coil, if it's like this. Right? They call it a coil, I'm not sure. So, okay. They have all these amino acids. They can interact with each other, right? Just like the hydrogen, the hydroxyls in starch could interact with each other, form bonds, right? So we have also serines and glutamates could form connections to each other. On the other hand, there's a lot of different ones. Here I've just made a separation between the hydrophilic side chains, which I've colored red, and the hydrophobic, which are white. Hydrophobic white, hydrophilic red. So for one thing, this is an aqueous solution. You might think that the hydrophobic ones, white, could get together. In fact, this could like fold up on itself and then get together with another one, and then maybe one from over here and one from over here. And so we could start to fold this protein. And then we'd end up maybe, I guess, with also interactions between, let's say, a lysine positive and a glutamate negative that could help put in this structure. We'd end up with something that could be folded up. But look how we chose what we went to. We could say this could go here, but on the other hand, it could also go here, right? So how many combinations are there? How many structures could we write? And you say, well, you could make lots of structures, but some will be better than others, right? Some will be more stable than others. Some, you have these bonds, they're weak, they come apart, and they try a different one. So maybe the molecule then starts to explore all the possible ways it could interact with itself in order to fold. So in the, again in the 60s or 70s, late 60s I think, just about the time he came to Columbia, this is a guy named Cyrus Leventhal who actually rebuilt the biology department in the 70s. He was a physicist and turned biologist. And so he calculated, he made this pretty good calculation of how long it would take to explore all the possibilities for even a modest size polypeptide. And the number came out to be longer than the life of the universe for one molecule to explore all the possibilities. This became the Leventhal number or the Leventhal paradox, right? And sometimes like silly people say, like, how could he think that, you know, that it would take so long? Of course it couldn't take so long. It happens quickly, right? So he just pointed out that is not the way they fold. But he didn't know how they fold. And we still don't know how they fold, really. That we still can't go from first principles and say, this is a leucine. I can measure the hydrophobicity of this leucine by looking at its behavior in getting into octane versus water, different pHs. I could put some number on it. I could see how strong the hydrogen bonds are for an hydroxyl and a serine. And we can measure all these things for the free amino acids, and we string them together, and we say, let's figure out then what would maximize all the interactions, make the strongest bonds. This works for smallish peptides, maybe even 30, best case, maybe 50. But when you get into real proteins that are 100, 200, 500 long, it generally fails, starting from scratch like that. So maybe they aren't folded up in a very particular way, and we get a big difference. If we go into our jacuzzi and pick up the molecule, actually looks like this, our first molecule. Our first molecule looks like this, let's say. Notice all the red stuff, which is the hydrophilic groups, are on the outside, and all the white hydrophobics are in the inside. This is somewhat of an exaggeration, but it's generally true. Right? That makes sense. All the hydrophobics get together on the inside by hydrophobic forces. The hydrophilics interact with water on the outside. But clearly, if there were another solution to this, if I went in and took a second molecule, it would look quite different. We pick up our second molecule, and it looks, in fact, exactly the same. And it wasn't easy for me to fold these so all the red would come out on the outside. Here's 10,000 atoms, or more. This is 500 amino acids, and we can figure it out. All in the same relationship to each other in three-dimensional space. And here's another one, again, folds it exactly the same way. Now, occasionally I get a fit of conscience, and I have to tell you that, well, maybe not exactly, but pretty much. And it's best to think of it as exactly the same way. So how does that work? How could it possibly know how to start? Well, maybe we're looking at it in the wrong way. These are in the cells, after all. Cells complicated, all these organelles, all these machines, molecular machines. Maybe there's a folder that says, if you're going to fold this protein, take this to this and not to any other. Some kind of template, some kind of scaffold which forces the folding. It's possible. Right? In some ways, you know, it makes sense. This is how DNA works, for example. Right? Use a template to tell you what to do. Well, you can do an experiment to test that out. You could take one of these things, purify it away from all the other cellular machinery. You just have this pure million molecules of protein. And then unfold it. And then use some harsh method to unfold it, to break these weak bonds. You can do it. How would we do it? What's a good way to take it out of its unnatural state, to denaturalize it, to denature it? Denature is the word. Right. So what could we use? Heat is the first answer and is the most obvious choice and a good answer. Right. So okay, let's heat it. Let's take a solution of egg albumin and heat it up and see what happens. So we've all done this experiment. We take a hen's egg, and we put it in boiling water, and we wait 5 minutes. Look at it again, take off the shell, and you see the big difference from a raw egg. A raw egg, it's liquid, it's pretty viscous, it's so concentrated with this albumin, mostly albumin. And so it's changed into this gel. Right? So what's happened here? Well, okay. So now it's looking more like this. Each molecule may be randomly present, but there's so much of it and so bumping into each other, so concentrated, that maybe this part, hydrophobic part of one molecule, interacts with the hydrophobic group of another molecule, and then this one with a third one, and this one with a fourth one, and that fourth one with another one, and pretty soon you have a network, a gridwork of these long coils all tangled up to one another. And so that forms a gel. That's about how you get Jell-O, except it's polysaccharide there, not protein. Okay, so we've denatured it, and it had this unfortunate consequence, but it's denatured. Let's cool it down. So we take our egg and we put it in the refrigerator, come back the next day, open it up. What do we see? Same thing. So, okay, we can't renature it. We must be missing the folder, but wait a minute. Maybe the experiment was a little too harsh, because think of this tangle. How's it going to first of all, it's got to extricate, each molecule extricate itself from this network in order to refold into this nice structure. And the extrication just takes too long. Maybe if we waited 1,000 years and had a 1,000-year-old egg, then it would turn liquid again. But we don't have that long. So let's repeat the experiment. Actually, I have all this. Right? Don't really need the visuals. Said all that. So here's our experiment. All done. It did not renature. And there's my explanation for it. So let's use maybe heat was kind of drastic, and concentration was so high it was kind of lent itself towards this entanglement. Let's repeat the experiment in a better way. So what else could we use to denature besides heat? pH, I hear. Yes, pH could affect the ionic state of many of the bonds if they're responsible for holding it together. And in general, pH does denature proteins. So that's one other possibility. What else? What's holding this whole thing together has got to be just those four types of weak bonds that we talked about. So, what do you got to lose? I'll never remember what you said, who we said it. Electricity, yes. So electricity is sometimes offered at this point. And it turns out that although it seems reasonable, it is not a factor. We can put proteins in this 3,000 volts of electrophoresis apparatus in a gel, maybe, instead of paper, and they will move, and they will not be disturbed by an electrical force. It's just sort of over the whole thing. It doesn't sort of pull one piece away from the other. What kind of solvent? Well, they're in water to begin with. Right? You're not loud enough. A solvent. Solvent's the right answer, but tell me what solvent. What? Come on. Ethanol. Benzene. What are the solvents we've talked about? High salt. Organic solvent. Organic solvent. What should an organic solvent do? Why should it denature it? Suppose the protein enters an organic solvent. You mix it up with octane. You have water-octane mixture, as we had before. And one venturesome protein molecule gets in there, or can't help it because you shake it up, and it goes momentarily into this octane molecule, even though it's half hydrophilic on the outside. It gets in there. What's going to happen to it? What force is going to be affected? The ionic bonds? What? Go ahead. Don't raise your hand. Shout out. The hydrophobic attractions will be reversed. So I like the beginning of that. If there's no water, it's an octane, where are the hydrophobic forces? They are non-existent. There is no entropy effect for them anymore. There's nothing to hold them together by hydrophobic forces. So they don't have to be reversed. They just have to be not there. They're not there, the whole thing just opens up, falls apart, which is why we don't drink gasoline. So, yeah, so these are some. Sometimes I get UV light or radiation like x-rays, and these have small effects, but they're not big effects. Even high salt generally is not bad. So what do we have? We have heat, we have pH, we have solvents, and we have one more, which is not at all obvious, which is called a chaotropic agent. Causes chaos, and we don't know exactly how they work, but here's an example of the most popular one. It's called urea, because it's found in the urine. It's a way we excrete our nitrogen. And just look at this molecule. It is just polar par excellence. You know, it's got form hydrogen bonds all over the place, one kind or another. And we use it at a very high concentration, like 7 molar, in which it's actually in the ballpark with the number of water molecules, which is 55 molar in pure water, and be less than a 7 molar reaction. So this will interfere with hydrogen bonding in the protein molecules, and it's kind of, a mild denaturant. Denature most proteins, and so they will be converted into this unfolded state. So let's take this chaotropic agent and do the whole experiment in a very more careful way. And instead of this big 500 amino acid albumin, let's take something more like 150 or so protein ribonuclease. Ribonuclease has the advantage of, unlike albumin, which just sort of sits there, ribonuclease, as you can tell from its name, is an enzyme, has catalytic activity. What does it do? It cleaves, because of the ACE, it hydrolyzes ribonucleic acid, which we haven't learned about yet, but it's another polymer. So this will chop up ribonucleic acid by hydrolysis. And so in order to do that, it has to be folded into a perfect reproduction of its original native form. Only the native enzyme will have catalytic activity. So we have a very stringent criterion for correct folding. Other ways we can tell if it's folded is does it behave like a compact molecule as opposed to an extended molecule, more physical type measurements, which are not quite as good, although they're useful. We're going to add urea to denature it, get it into this random coil state, and then we're going to take out the urea and ask whether it renatures. And the way we're going to do this gradually is, since urea is a chemical denaturant, we're going to add it, and we're going to add it and subtract it, mostly subtract it, in a gradual manner. We can do this by a technique called dialysis. So dialysis is a rather simple discriminating technique in which you have what's critical is you have this membrane material, sort of like cellophane, or some kind of plastic material. It's flexible, and it has effective pore sizes in it that will allow small molecules like glucose or lactose or water or urea to go through easily, but large molecules like ribonuclease and albumin and large peptides even cannot get through the holes in this membrane. If we take a solution of our compact ribonuclease, which is catalytically active, and we put it into a beaker of urea, the urea molecules and the water molecules will freely go back and forth until, after an hour or so, they will have equilibrated on both sides of this membrane and be the same inside and outside. So we could start, say, with 1 molar or 2 molar, then go to 7 molar. By the time we get to 7 molar, and then we look at what's happened to the protein has unraveled and is in this random coil state. And we test it for its catalytic activity, nothing. Unable to degrade ribonuclease. And now we do the critical experiment. We dialyze out the urea. And this we can do gradually. So we give a chance for a few minutes or hours for the ribonuclease molecules to form their strongest bonds first. And so we put it from 7 molar, we put it into 6 molar and wait an hour, and then take the bag out and put it in another beaker with 5 molar, 4 molar, 3 molar, 2 molar, 0.5 molar, 1/10 molar, none. So now we're back to our original state before we added the urea. And indeed, we find that the protein has regained its compact form. It's not extended anymore. And that it carries out, once again, the catalysis of the hydrolysis of ribonucleic acid. So we have renatured it. And what we put in here was pure ribonuclease, no other cellular component. So ribonuclease by itself was able to renature. The experiment's actually a little more complicated than this if you read it in your book. But that's essentially the result. And so we can conclude from this positive result. A negative result you can explain many different ways. There's something going wrong with your experiment. But it's very hard to explain a positive result like this without using the conclusion that it's all was here was the primary structure of that protein, and it ended up in its tertiary structure, which is its three-dimensional shape of a polypeptide called a tertiary structure. and that primary structure determines tertiary structure. This experiment was done in the late 50s by a fellow named Christian Anthonsen, got the Nobel Prize for it, and it's hard to overstate the importance of this experiment because it's the proteins and that do the jobs, right? And they can only do the jobs if they are folded, if they exist in a particular three-dimensional state. That's part and parcel of their jobs. Hemoglobin will not bind oxygen unless it's folded exactly right. Ribonucleus will not break down that RNA and let you get energy from RNA when you eat it, unless it's in its perfectly folded state. So we have these thousands of proteins that have to be folded correctly. And so where the information is coming from is only, for most of them anyway, at least for ribonuclease, and this has been repeated for many experiments, sometimes it works, often it works, sometimes it doesn't. Whenever it doesn't, it's a negative result, and we could maybe explain it away. But the positive result is at the heart of life, because life is these proteins doing their jobs in a way. And they have DNA to carry the information for that primary sequence, as you'll see. And that primary sequence, then, is all you need for the job to get done. And the job is life. So, the Anthonsen experiment, as it's called. Here's a modern version of the Anthonsen experiment carried out in a laboratory here in our biology department by Julio Fernandez and his colleagues. Now, here's a case where you can take a single molecule. I always say, well, you can't take a single molecule. But nowadays, the last 10, 15 years, there are techniques that are developed. Julio Fernandez, Ruben Gonzalez in the chemistry department, they are dealing with single molecules. What Julio does is like use the atomic force microscope and attach. This is a protein that has a bunch of folded parts in it called domains. And they're folded, you know, in this same way, and it's like a repeated structure. It's a very large protein called titin. And he can attach one end to the slide and one end to this puller. And then he can pull with great precision, measure how many newtons of force, how many piconewtons of force he can apply. And so he applies some force, and nothing happens, and he applies a little more force, and nothing happens, like he's bending over here, and then at some point, all of a sudden, this gets longer, and he can measure how long it is. Right? So he's pulled apart, he's denatured one of these domains. And so he can watch them, he has a whole series of them, watch them denature, and then the force goes down again, you have to start pulling, because it's become relaxed, doesn't have that tension due to the folding. But for our purposes, we can consider the reverse experiment is that when he relaxes the pulling, it goes back into its folded state, and he can repeat that pulling and reproduce all that series of peaks exactly. So here he's denaturing by something we wouldn't have thought as a good denaturant, is you just take one molecule and pull it, right? And it snaps back. All that said, we have to admit that although I hope you have now, accepted the principle of the positive result, that primary structure determines tertiary structure, that's not to say they might not need some help sometime. But this help is generally of a nonspecific form. So there are scaffolds or structures in the cell that aid in folding. And their main job is, though, not to direct the folding so much as to prevent what happened to that egg, is to put the protein after it's, say, just been synthesized, and we don't know how that works yet, except from your high school, but you will soon learn it. So it's just been synthesized, and you want it to fold in the next few seconds correctly, so you stick it in a box, isolated away from everything else, so that it doesn't make these illegitimate connections with other molecules. And in this box, got like a Teflon interior, so it doesn't interfere with the folding. So it stays in there a little while. Actually, some energy is required, and then you take the lid off the box, and the protein comes out. This seems quite fanciful, but. So one reason you might want to have some help is while you're folding it to prevent illegitimate interactions. However, there's another other circumstances where you get denaturation naturally in cells. So for instance, there's a lot of proteins that enter into organelles like the mitochondria, and in getting in, they have to cross a membrane barrier. When they cross the membrane barrier, it's like doing that denaturation experiment, putting them in octane. So as soon as they're in the middle of this, all these fatty acid tails, it's like being in octane. There's no more hydrophobic force on them, so they denature. And then they come out at the other end, and they're all unraveled. But waiting for them at the other side of the membrane are the chaperonins. And they, again, stick them into this box. Maybe they're not all like boxes, but the boxes are the one that's investigated the most. Looks like this. The unraveled up protein gets in through the top here, sits there, then you put the lid on, and then you wait, and then you take the lid off, and folded protein comes out. Presto. How that happens is not completely understood. So given that there are these chaperonins, but they play sort of a modulating role and not the primary role in how something folds. So I told you that you don't know how things fold, but I did leave out something. You don't know how these fold, but you can tell whether they're folded or not. So you can tell that this is in fact a structure by determining the structure after it's all folded. And you do that by taking a lot of this protein and concentrating it and adding some salts, which are a little bit magical. You know, what salt you use and what pH you use, and you fool around with many different conditions. Even now robots are doing it as we speak here on campus, until you find just the right conditions so that enough of these protein molecules associated with each other in exactly the same way, and you get millions of them, and they form a crystal. And now you can take this crystal and shine X-rays through it, and the X-rays will be diffracted away depending on where the atoms are here. And then you can measure this angle of diffraction on some sensor. It used to be film. Now it's a photo sensor. And you plug this into a computer, and you used to have to calculate it. So and they will say, and it will tell you where all the atoms are, as long as you have millions, so you have a big enough signal to see. And they will all go at the same angle. They all have to be lined up the same way. So the hard part today is crystallizing them. And there's now thousands of protein structures that have been determined in this way. This is sort of the gold standard for determining structure. There's other ways. And there's a big push by the NIH over the last 10 years or so to get as many of these structures down as possible, because structure determines function. So the more structures we know, the better we'll be at being able to predict what is this protein that's affected in this disease, and we can't connect it so easily to a shape of a sickle cell. But the person has, you know, mental retardation or diabetes, and we don't know what the protein's doing. So structure will give us a clue, perhaps, to the function. It would be a lot easier if we could predict it. And predictions have started to are more successful by looking at structures already known, and they see certain commonalities. It's sort of like if you think doing it from scratch is the pure best way from the principles of the amino acids, that you can't do that. But if you start to make analogies, you can get more and more successful. And lately, what I've seen in the popular news is a program that some of these protein structural biochemists have put together, which is called FoldIt. I haven't seen it myself, but maybe you'll try it out. FoldIt, one word. Just Google it. And you'll come to a site where you can be given the chance as a video game player of folding a protein. They might know the structure of this protein, and your job is to see how close you get it to the real conformation. And they will presumably teach you something about the affinities. Or you will get a feel for the affinities, maybe. You will get see what works and what snaps in and what doesn't. And they're hoping, actually, to get some insight. If they have hundreds of thousands of players playing this game, It may be more efficient putting this human intuition into it than rather getting a supercomputer to try out all those possibilities, because they're up against the Leventhal number there. There has to be some way to nucleate the process, to start it here and then spread from it, to commit yourself to one pathway. So in the article I read, they're talking about protein savants, protein folding savants, who just have a knack for doing this, right? So it might be fun to look at that site. This morning I was 10 minutes late to lecture, so tonight we're going to leave 10 minutes early. That's it.